Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are collectively the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build and maintain gardens in New York City and the surrounding area. And our show aims to bring some culture to horticulture.
And we are exhausted.
Yeah. Can we just gripe for a second? We have been working nonstop, and so has our crew, for 3 months.
Right. Summer really only came, like, plant-wise, one month ago.
Yeah, barely. So on the solstice, the longest day of the year, we decided to come back into the studio. It seems appropriate. There's like a big moon and all the planets are aligned.
That's right. And full moon, summer solstice.
So I think it's the strawberry moon, right, Alice?
Yes.
And yep. I don't know what that means. Maybe one of our listeners can tell us what the strawberry...
Honeymoon is what I...
Oh, really?
It's the honeymoon is what I read.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, reach out to us if you know what kind of moon it is.
Yeah. Moon or honey, strawberry.
Whatever.
Two great tastes. Taste great together.
We wanted to just give a shout out to Kim Hallbrook Ellis, who wrote us a really sweet note this week. Super excited about having us back. And we're back. We're happy to be back. We're having three summer specials, one this month today, then one in July, which is going to have a kind of political bent.
Yes.
And we're not going to give it all away, but we'll let you know.
We are not going to talk about Trump, though.
No, we're not. Although we might. We might talk, you know, who knows if he'll still be.
I'm not going to talk about Trump.
Well, we'll see if he's still in play at that point,
right.
You know.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
It's going to be July 11th. And then we have a super special one in August as well about a really interesting project that Alice and I are working on.
Let me say one thing before we get into today's topic, because it relates to the topic. We're going to talk today about travel writing.
Yes.
And the summer solstice is today. Mm-hmm. And 31 years ago, is that right? Yes. 21 years ago, I was in Ireland. And on this night... I was studying landscape painting. We went to Cool Park, which is the home of a woman that was a patron to Yeats and Shaw and all the great Irish writers. And I saw Midsummer's Night in this garden.
Oh, my God.
On
that must
solstice.
Have been amazing.
So I'm having a bit of a romantic attachment to today's show because we're going to talk about travel writing and landscape.
And gardens that can only be sort of
exactly.
in that place.
Yeah.
So, you know, people a lot of times don't think about gardeners as people who travel a lot, right? They're kind of like the types that are the salt of the earth. They settle down. They make a kind of permanent place for themselves. And they're kind of nurturers by nature. And, you know, their gardens needs attention, and it kind of keeps them rooted in one place. And they're always like building and enlarging or editing, you know. So you don't think of them as being like the wanderlust types. And you know, if you work at gardening for pleasure or for work, you know, as a profession, you can't usually leave for too long,
right?
You know, like you can't take extended stays.
But let me beg to differ, because the whole point of having a garden, I think, is to bring the world to your footsteps and to participate in the very earliest of craft, right?
It's true.
So, you know, a garden is a collection of plants from all over the world. So one can travel
virtually,
you know, yes, in your own garden.
Exactly. So our guest has done a lot of that. and she's going to talk about that. So before you abandon your garden and go off
and listen to our podcast,
you know, when we do travel, when Alice and I do travel, we try to include like a garden or two in the itinerary.
Yeah.
And the people that are with us traveling, sometimes they're happy about it, sometimes they're not, you know.
Just ask Carmen's boy who's 16.
Yeah, yeah. He's, you know,
he does not want to go to travel.
No, he doesn't like that. They have to suck it up, though. I make them go. And, you know, after they've experienced it, if at first there's resistance, they're actually happy about it.
Right.
You know? So we usually put these plans in motion by May. And, mm-hmm, like, by mid-May, like, the itch to get out starts like really burning, you know, like you want to get out. By mid-June, we've planned and planted so many spaces and cultivated and worried about so many different plants that we're kind of like on this horticultural overload, you know, like it can't even think about anything but summer,
uh-huh,
you know. So that's what we thought today, summer solstice, we're going to talk about going
traveling
out, traveling virtually or otherwise. And this is what one of my favorite travel writers has to say on the subject of travel. Pico Ier, he says, I quote, "Travel is like love, mostly because it's a heightened state of awareness in which we are mindful, receptive, undimmed by familiarity, and ready to be transformed. That is why the best trips, like the best love affairs, really never end."
Yes, hence my evening in Yates's garden.
That you still remember.
I will vividly forever take that to the grave with me, which is the best part of traveling.
Yes.
Because that's really what you're left with.
The memory.
The memories.
And the experience. So, mm-hmm, Alice, tell our listeners about our latest guest, our today's guest, who, you know, has done a lot of traveling.
Yeah. So Yvonne Horn is a fellow Garden Writers Association member. She reached out to us in the thick of the spring season with photos of her garden travels. And we knew she would be the most ideal guest to kick off our summer special with. So it was only April, and we already wanted to escape to somebody else's garden, and she provided the opportunity to do so. So Yvonne is a professional, full-time travel writer and photographer. She travels the world to see fabulous cities and natural wonders, and also travels to wander through gardens. She seeks out gardens that could not exist in any other place than where they are. She looks for gardens that reflect the gardener's passion, gardeners with historical tales to tell, gardens with a bit of wacky embedded in their beauty. When she is not traveling the world as an award-winning travel journalist, www.yvonnehorn.com, she spends her time pulling weeds and moving plants around in her own backyard in Northern California, Sonoma County. With a click, you'll read about an Alice in Wonderland-like garden in Boquete, a garden dedicated to an ancient shipwreck in Stockholm, a poisoned garden in England, and many, many, many more. Yvonne, welcome to the show.
Ah, Carmen and Alice.
Hi.
I'm pleased to be with you today.
How are you? Okay, so let's start with some of your travel writing. How did you get started, and how did that evolve into writing about gardens as well?
Well, let's see. First of all, I'm not a trained journalist. I didn't major in journalism or communications or anything like that. Music and theater was my life. But this was back in the early 1980s, and a friend asked if I'd go with her to an adult education writing class, and it was a short story. I wrote a story, and darn, it sold.
Oh, great.
It was amazing. My friend abandoned the class, but then the next session was nonfiction writing. And I had to get my head around this because I hadn't even thought that a lot of the material in publications and newspapers is written by freelancers.
Right.
And again, I was immediately successful and was soon writing for publications ranging in everything from Popular Mechanics to Glamour.
That's quite a range.
I've always been a freelancer, but never worked for publication. Travel writing came when in the mountains of mail that arrived daily, this is 1987 before we had email, I received a press trip invitation to go to South Africa. I didn't even have a passport. And with that foray into the world, I turned my attention to travel writing and didn't stop.
Uh-huh.
And in my writing, I'd actually been writing about gardens for some time, things like how to stake a tree or the best kind of vegetables for children to try in a garden, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
But the first garden I wrote about, and this was not until spring of 2001, I looked back at through my files and found it. It was incorporated into a larger story on Wales. And I wrote about the just-opened National Botanic Garden of Wales,
mm-hmm.
the first botanical garden to be established in the UK in 200 years.
Wow.
And the purpose of the garden was to showcase endangered plants with conservation, research, education, sustainability as its focus. Oh, that was interesting stuff. But that garden could have been built anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So that made me think of why certain gardens in my travels, I've always looked at gardens because I've been a gardener all my life. My parents were gardeners. My grandparents were gardeners. I just always liked gardens.
Uh-huh.
That made me think of why certain gardens in my travels interested me so much, while others I simply admired.
Right.
The gardens that captivated me were gardens that could be nowhere else than where they are.
Yeah.
Gardens with a tale to tell. Gardens that showcase the creativity of their creator. And if there were all three, and this doesn't happen all that often, you know, bingo.
Right.
So that begs the question, when you go to these far-flung places, how do you find the gardens,
yeah.
Yvonne? How do you, now it's a lot easier, I'm sure, now with the internet, you can do lots of searches before you take off. But before that happened, how did you find these odd, one-off kind of unique places?
Well, whenever I'm going somewhere, just as you said, I do a whole lot of research. And I just search and search and search until I finally find something. You can go through, a lot of places have garden associations or local gardening groups, and oftentimes those have websites. And you can finally kind of ferret out something that you think, gosh, I think that one's really worth investigating. So that's how I find them. And so then I purposely go visit them when I'm on my travels.
Tell us some stories, because I'm sure you have a fascinating repertoire of.
Well, I want to ask her about a specific place.
Yeah,
though,
that's, yeah.
Let's start with Macau.
Yeah,
Yvonne.
That
one. You have so many stories on your website, but that one really intrigued me. You called it A Tale of Two Gardens, and that really appealed to me on a few levels, but especially because it revealed a lot about the history of the place, the commerce, and also about plant exploration. And they're two very different gardens located not too far from each other. Isn't that correct?
You know, absolutely. And it was a real eye-opener for me. I had made contact with Antonio Sariva, and he was a recently retired man that oversaw all of Macau's public spaces to see if he might, you know, spend some time with me. And he took me about, and we visited two of the city's gardens that illustrated the two very different civilizations that coexisted in Macau for over 450 years. The European and the Chinese, dating to the early 1500s when the Portuguese sailed into the city's inner harbor and stayed. Their tenure ended in 1999 with much less fanfare, 2 years after Britain handed control over to Hong Kong back to China.
Mm-hmm.
The Macau was handed back to China in 1999.
Well, it's interesting. Almost everybody knows where Hong Kong is. Where is Macau? Yeah. For those who don't know, where is Macau on the globe?
Well, let's see. How can I describe? I would say Macau is, let's see if I got my directions right. As a travel writer, I sometimes don't get my directions right. It would be to the west of Hong Kong. And you can get between the two by ferry, actually.
Oh.
It takes maybe 45 minutes or something like that.
Okay.
So we're talking about a place that has been inhabited by Europeans since the Renaissance, right?
Yeah, since the early 1500s.
That's so incredible.
So he took me, I think so, and they lived there peacefully. And he took me first to a classic Chinese garden. And he pointed out as we walked around the rocks that were pieced together to simulate, you know, high mountains. And there were areas that were separated by stone walls with windows, intricately shaped windows that you could peek through. Gives you an impression that you're looking far away. And small spaces opening onto the more spacious ones. By contrast, they appear much bigger. And he pointed out the plants. There's a whole list of the laundry list of plants that must always be present in the Chinese garden. But the most important of those is the lotus. Born from mud, it emerges clear and clean, a symbol of purity.
Yes.
Well, with that, he took me to another garden, the European garden.
Mm.
Built about the same time, but here designed to be nature at its most idyllic. Nothing enclosed, stands of trees, sweeps of grass, and mostly showcasing plants that were brought back from the turn of last century by those intrepid plant hunters.
Yeah.
The gathering of plants from various parts of the world, oftentimes from the east, most likely, Far East, were especially enjoyed by the European and especially by the English at that time. So here we have two different gardens, but enjoyed equally by the Macaus, the Chinese and the European population.
Right. If,
for example, a foursome of Caucasian men were playing cards in a shelter pavilion in the Chinese garden when we visited. And in the English garden, a practice session of Chinese opera was underway.
That's great. That's just so amazing. And isn't it true, Yvonne, that some of the plant, that garden was used as sort of a staging area to get plants from Asia to Kew in England?
Oh, tell me that again. I didn't quite catch it.
Oh, I was saying, wasn't that garden sort of a staging area to get some of the plants that were hunted brought to Kew Gardens in England as well?
Oh, if I catch what you mean. In England, you know, there was so many gardens. The estates were kind of vying for each other to see who could have the most exotic plants.
Yes.
Right.
And the most absolutely exotic things were brought back. And it was a great time. The Victorian era was a great time for that sort of stuff going on.
Yeah. And they brought plants from Asia. Because Macau has a kind of subtropical climate, right? Isn't it pretty warm there?
Just a minute. This, my cell phone is doing something cuckoo.
Okay. We'll stay on the line.
It's great how...
I think I'm okay.
Okay.
Let's see. Tell me again what you're saying.
Oh, we were saying Macau has a kind of subtropical climate.
I hadn't thought about that. But probably the plants from Southeast Asia would be, you know, perfectly suitable there.
Yeah. So
that, the thing that's really struck me about it was that how these two gardens just so dramatically illustrated the two cultures that have lived there peacefully side by side for nearly 500 years and still going on, even though, you know, the control has certainly changed.
All right, of course. And then you went, let's go to a completely opposite part of the globe now. So we go from subtropical Macau to Iceland, right? I don't think about gardens in Iceland, right?
I don't even think about plants in Iceland.
No, right? I mean, not too far from the Arctic Circle, you discovered a garden that was a new botanical garden that was made by housewives of this town called Akureyri. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that, I was driving the Ring Road in Iceland, and so my research picked this one up. And even though there's a botanical garden in Reykjavik, this one in the very far north really intrigued me. And I don't know that much about it because, unfortunately, my correspondence, and I couldn't get anybody to talk with me or email me or anyway before I left the trip. And then when I got there, there was no one there to talk to. So I didn't get any information about it really until after I'd returned home. But the garden itself is just, it's just beautifully situated. It's not the most northerly garden. Norway and Russia have botanical gardens that are more northerly. But its setting is absolutely spectacular. At the base of a long fjord and edged with Bennett Mountains, this is a little town. I think there's about 18,000 people. It's Iceland's second largest town. And it has a mild climate, so if you're going to build a botanical garden in Iceland, it probably is a good spot.
That sounds like the beginning of a joke. You know?
But what's fascinating is that it was just local women who started it.
The town is charming, and so maybe it's the efforts of these town women that have made it so charming through the years. But in 1912, some women got together and decided their city needed more beautifying. And so they found this piece of land. Oh, it's on a high hill, a little overlooking the city proper. And you can see the fjord in the distance. It's really quite lovely setting. And they went about, you know, gardening in it and planting stuff and making it look pretty and having to be kind of like a city park. And they kept at it until it was turned over to the city in 1953. And at that time, it became a botanic garden. And the story of how it became a botanic garden is a little bit too involved to try and get
sure.
into here. But they did find someone who was interested in doing that. And their goal here is to display native flora. At the same time, while searching for non-native species that would be suitable for Icelandic survival. So it's very much of the place, and I like that too.
Mm-hmm. And Yvonne, what plants did you see there that surprised you that were thriving in Iceland?
Pardon me?
What plants were you surprised to find doing well in that garden?
I don't know. For some reason, I'm having trouble understanding you.
What plants did you see at the Botanic Garden in Iceland?
Yvonne, can you hear us?
I'm here. I'm still having trouble understanding what you're saying.
Oh.
We're just asking what plants you saw at that Botanic Garden.
Oh, about the plants I saw?
Yes.
I was so surprised. There are a lot of plants I have in my garden.
Yes.
In Northern California.
Right. That's what was, when I looked at the photos, I saw things that I wouldn't expect to live, wouldn't expect to see living in Iceland.
I was amazed. And I think it's because they have a greenhouse, and they start these plants like I have in my garden here at home. In their greenhouse, and so then when the days are long and sunny, you know, they get going really fast. And so there's these big masses of decorative areas that you probably saw from the photos that have these kind of plants in them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the botanical part of the garden is a little more structured than that, and the plants look different. But I was amazed. I was so surprised at the color. I just didn't think.
Yes, that's what struck me as well. I was expecting like alpine sort of plants and a lot of evergreens and, you know, that kind of stuff. But there was a lot of color. So we have to talk about, we would be remiss if we didn't discuss the monastery garden in Germany that you write about that inspired one of the first garden books called Hortulus, penned by this intrepid abbot who has a really great name. His name is Walarid the Squinter.
You know, I love that. You know, at that time, they just called people the way they saw them.
Yeah,
I love it.
John the Stupid and Frederick the Fat. Yeah.
If only we could do that again today.
I wish we could. Oh, yeah. My God. Well, here's what Walarid, a 19th century monk,
Ninth century monk
has this to say in the preface to his book called Hortulus, which, by the way, you can buy on Amazon. Okay, yes. You can buy this. Here's what Walrus said. I myself learned this not solely from opinion, common report, nor from searches of books and early writings, but by work and hands-on study to discover proven methods, which considerably postpone my leisure at the end of each day. And I thought, you know what? Walrus's words are totally perfectly suited for today, because most people are just searching things and not actually doing things.
Yes.
So tell us about this garden, Yvonne.
What you just quoted, at the end of each day, and that's when he was doing his penning by candlelight.
Yes. Right.
So no wonder he was Walford the Squitter.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Again, you know, this is on Lake Constance in southern Germany, just, you know, near the Austrian border. It's a beautiful area dotted with islands and all these little fairy tale villages. And one of the islands, the island of Reichenau, was uninhabited when an itinerant bishop received consent to take possession of the entire island for his monastery. And today there's so many remnants of that rich history of Middle Ages that the whole island is a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Wow.
But, again, as you said, my reason for going was this translated copy of the Squinter's book. And I thought, I wonder if I couldn't find if there was anything there that would really kind of show his garden. So I went there blind. He was squinting. I went there blind.
That's good.
One of the world's first garden books in hand. So I followed a path to one side of the church where he served, as you mentioned, in 842 and 849. And there they had a reproduction of his working garden placed in the same spot where he put it.
Oh,
that's awesome. Wow.
Not large.
Right, right.
Orderly rows with meticulously labeled plants described that he described in his book.
Yvonne?
If it had been at a different time of year, there would have been more plants for me to observe.
Right.
In this case, there was, maybe three-quarters of the ones that he described in his book.
Okay.
And as you know, it was a medicinal.
Right.
It was his purpose was medicinal, medicinal plant. But they were... So it was really pretty exciting to me.
Yeah, I mean, to travel back in time virtually, like we were talking about, and see something that someone created, you know, over 1,000 years ago in that same spot, and then read his book and read about what he thought of the plants, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Did he have good advice, Yvonne? Did he have good plant advice?
No, I haven't thought about that. I have no medical advice for you for this at the moment. But I bet we could find plenty.
Yeah, and in terms of the timing, that was well before the binomial system was put in place, hundreds of years before.
Right, right.
So the plants that he's describing, who knows, you know, I don't know where he was probably using ancient names for them or inventing things or used like folkloric names and common names for them, which is interesting as well. Mm-hmm. So we have to take a break, Yvonne. Stay on the line. We'll come back in just a few minutes to talk more with Yvonne Horn. Stay tuned to We Dig Plants.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you.
Welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. Today we're talking about, it's our summer special, and we're talking about travel writing and gardens, visiting gardens. Today with Yvonne Horn, we have traveled from China to Iceland to Germany. And now, Yvonne, tell us two or three favorite gardens that you've discovered and why they're the most interesting to you.
Yvonne, are you with us?
I'm here.
Okay.
So, Yvonne, tell us about two or three of your favorite gardens and trips that you've taken.
Oh, you know, it's almost like asking me to choose my favorite child.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many that I just absolutely love, but I think of them, I absolutely loved Cocodera in Kyoto. And this is a garden. It was designed in the 14th century. It surrounds Saihoji Temple. Mm-hmm. And they were very original for the time because they were a garden to be enjoyed as an earthly pleasure and not a religious exercise.
Oh.
And paths invited strolling and flat-bottomed boats took visitors about. And the emperor was frequently seen night boating his way lit by a tall candle. And for 600 years, temple priests did their best to maintain the garden through wars and fires and floods. And finally, only one monk was assigned to its care. And in the weather there, wet and humid, the weather had its way and moss began to grow unhampered. And Cocodera became known as the Moss Temple, and tourists began to show up. They showed up in droves. And bus fumes began to affect the moss, and the feet were pounding it and pulverizing it. Drastic changes had to be made. No longer could anyone just show up at the temple door and knock and get in. A permit had to be applied for. And also, one could not tour the garden, another rule, until they participated in a Zen contemplative experience.
Hmm.
So I sent in my application, I think it was 2 weeks in advance, I can't remember exactly, and was prepared for a Zen experience. I didn't know what it was going to be. And it had me sitting at an inches high desk on the floor, wincing in pain as I had to sift from hip to hip and trace a sutra of, I think it was 178 characters before I could be sent off to the garden.
Oh, wow.
And I was doing my best, and everyone else around me, of course, you know, the Japanese were sitting that way and no problem at all. And finally, a priest, an English-speaking priest, came up and whispered that I could write my name on the paper along with a wish and place it in front of the shrine.
Okay.
Ah, I was released, and now I could go wander the garden.
Yeah.
That's a pretty steep price of admission.
Yeah. You had to work for that one.
And enter is absolutely cushioned quiet. And pathways lead to endless variations on the theme of green moss-covered bridges, and moss encircled the tree trunks. And looking in the water, I fully expect to see moss-covered koi swimming in the moss. 123 varieties of moss have been identified in the garden.
Wow.
And attend the garden sweep it.
Oh.
Right.
Wow, yes. Well, what else?
Yeah.
So I suppose I should come up with a Zen meaning for the garden, and so let's call it accidental beauty reduced to a single element. Does that sound Zen enough for you?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Wow, that sounds like a great place to visit.
Another one that, another one that I just really loved was in England in Cornwall, and that would be St. Michael's Mount. And it's almost a mirror image of Mount St. Michel across the channel.
Mm.
If you see pictures of them, you'd think one was the other.
Oh, wow.
And to get to it, you you can go across at low tide and walk across a causeway when the tide is way out. And otherwise, they have a little shuttle boat that takes you back and forth. So if you stay too long and the tide comes in, you can get back. But most come to visit the grand rooms of the so-called castle that's perched atop the rock and lived in by the St. Albans family since 1646. And they don't come because there's no awareness that there is a garden there unless you look down from one of the windows or balcony and, wow, there's a garden there. And through the years, some 50 terraces had been carved into niches in the near vertical island. It's so steep that gardeners have to abseil in full harness from one level to another.
Wow.
If you take a misstep, you fall out of the garden.
Right. Well, I am not going to let our gardeners complain any longer then.
I don't believe I've ever known of a garden where, you know, that went on.
Yeah, that is deadly gardening.
Wow. They clip on and start clipping.
What's the insurance?
Right, and the gardeners hitch themselves together. You know?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's south-facing. And with the rock collecting the heat, you know, and during the day and releasing it in the evening, the plants flourish there. You know, there are all sorts of palms and succulents and citrus and lilies. And again, a lot of them dating back to that grand time for plant collectors.
Right.
In the Victorian area.
So for you to see it, Yvonne, you couldn't actually go into the garden. You just saw it from above, right? Like just... You couldn't.
Well, you see it from the bottom, and there's some bottom path. If you know the garden is there, you can go around the island, and there's some low pathways so you can kind of see up into it.
Uh-huh.
And see the various terracing that is going on throughout the years. But I was talking to Alan Cook, who's the head gardener, and as I was talking to him, the thought occurred to me, you know, hey, actually, this is just a big rock, you know, surrounded by water. So how did the soil get in there? Victorians come and haul buckets of it around? You know,
yeah.
How did it get there? And Alan filled me in, and I thought this was absolutely amazing. Until 1700 B.C., the rock, that enormous rock, was 6 miles inland. And leaves fell from the trees, and humus developed, and birds and worms went about their work. And then came a great flood, and it was all over. The rock in the forest was an island in the ocean, filled with wonderful gardening material.
Oh, my God.
Wow. That's amazing.
There needs to be... This is fascinating.
It's an incredible garden. Alan said to me, he's been there for 15 years, he said, I would never want to work anywhere else. To be a gardener anywhere else would be, well, tame.
Yeah.
Well, that's extraordinary.
That's an amazing story. I'm going to look that up.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I can see why that's one of your favorites.
You know, Cornwall has just a bevy of really interesting gardens and... But this one just really stuck in my mind.
Yeah.
I can understand that. I'm going to search some photos for it.
Yeah.
Well, Yvonne, it's been fascinating talking with you today. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time, and we might have to just do travel gardening part two at some point.
My goodness, time really did slip by.
Yeah. Well, I would like to share your website again. It's www.yvonnehorn.com. You can...
The one that is... Just here to read more about these gardens and I don't know how many others. The Traveling Gardener. And you have to put the there or you won't get there.
Yes, thetravelinggardener.com. Well, thank you so much, Yvonne, for spending time with us today. And keep us posted.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Alice is going to share some interesting quotes.
I've got some
about
quotes
travel.
About travel and landscape and gardening. And I'll just start this way. Lawrence Durrell, in A Spirit of Place, Letters and Essays on Travel. It is a pity indeed to travel and not get the essential sense of landscape values. You do not need a sixth sense for it. It is there if you just close your eyes and breathe softly through your nose. You will hear the whispered message. For all landscapes ask the same question in the same whisper. I'm watching you. Are you watching yourself in me? Most travelers hurry too much. The great thing is to try to travel with the eyes of the spirit wide open and not focus too much on factual information. To tune in without reverence, idly, but with real inward attention. It is to be had for the feeling. You can extract the essence of a place once you know it. If you just get as still as a needle, you'll be there. And I think that's really important in all of our hustle and bustle and all of our organizing of plants and trucks and, you know, get them in, get them out, get them planted. And I've got a party and make the garden look great. And people are coming for the barbecue. A garden is more than that. And that's why travel, it really forces you to slow down and to look. Another great one is written by a woman named Ann Dillard from her piece called Pilgrim at Tinker Creek.
Oh, that's a great book.
Thomas Merton wrote, "There is always a temptation to diddle around in the contemplative life, making itsy-bitsy statues. There is always an enormous temptation in all of life to diddle around making itsy-bitsy friends and meals and journeys for itsy-bitsy years on end. It is so self-conscious, so apparently moral, simply to step aside from the gaps where the creeks are and winds you and winds pour down, saying, I never merited this grace, quite rightly, and then to sulk along the rest of your days on the edge of rage. I won't have it. The world is wilder than all that, more dangerous and bitter, more extravagant and bright. We are making hay when we should be making whoopee. We are raising tomatoes when we should be raising Cain or Lazarus. Go up into the gaps. If you can find them, they shift and they vanish too. Stalk these gaps. Squeak into a gap and into the soil. Turn and unlock more than a maple, a universe. This is how you spend your afternoon and tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon. Spend the afternoon. You cannot take it with you." That's which nice. I thought was like,
yeah,
perfect.
That's awesome. I love that.
So I've got another one, the last one from Murakami, The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. "Sometimes when one is moving silently through such an utterly desolate landscape, an overwhelming hallucination can make one feel that oneself, as an individual human being, is slowly being unraveled. The surrounding space is so vast that it becomes increasingly difficult to keep a balanced grip on one's own being. The mind swells out to fill the entire landscape, becoming so diffuse in the process that one loses the ability to keep it fastened to the physical self. The sun would rise from the eastern horizon and cut its way across the empty sky and sink below the western horizon. This was the only perceptible change in our surroundings, and in the movement of the sun, I felt something I hardly know how to name, some huge cosmic love." On the solstice.
Perfect ending. Thank you for listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Please remember to follow us on Facebook, Groundworks Inc., We Dig Plants, or on Twitter, at We Dig Plants, to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows. You can also now follow us on Instagram at Groundworks Gardens NYC. Thanks for listening. See you in the garden.
Keep gardening. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.